it usually just starts with the stomping or the movement from the rocking from left to right, and you hear the foot motion going. And then from the foot motion going, you know, the hand clapping comes in simultaneously. But there isn't any pre-recording rhythm style. It's more being led by the spirit.
Reverend Jerry Colbert is senior pastor of John Wesley United Methodist Church in Annapolis. But as you'll hear on our program this hour, he's also one of the few remaining leaders of an increasingly rare musical tradition of worship that dates back to the formative days of African-American Christianity in early 19th century America.
We have what we call a verse hymn and a straight hymn. And we usually start our prayer meeting with what we call a verse hymn. It has a slow tempo, a slow movement, and you gradually, the tempo picks up. From there, you have a down period or a rest period of prayer time. And then from the prayer time, you go to another, what we call a verse hymn. And we go to a what we call a straight hymn, where you're just constantly repeating the same lines over and over and over again. And that's when the connection, the fire, the new birth, if we say so, comes in with the Holy Spirit. And folks just get caught up in the Spirit, and it's all over.
Welcome to The Signal, our weekly tour through the hidden corners of Maryland's cultural landscape. Our show this week is dedicated to the last vestiges of a Tidewater tradition known as the singing and praying bands. I'm Aaron Henkin, joined this hour by folklorist Cliff Murphy of Maryland Traditions and the Maryland State Arts Council. We've got a lot of interesting history to cover together, some fascinating interviews with elders and scholars of the singing and praying band tradition. But first, a moment to just soak in these sounds from a recent field recording Cliff made of Reverend Colbert and his group at Asbury Broadneck United Methodist Church in Annapolis. From Asbury Broadneck United Methodist Church in Annapolis, the sounds of the singing and praying bands, led by their captain, Reverend Jerry Colbert. Welcome again to The Signal, and Cliff Murphy, welcome again to you.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
So, Cliff, later this hour, we're going to meet 86-year-old Mary Allen. She's been in singing and praying bands ever since she was a 10-year-old girl. We're also going to get some historical background from scholar Jonathan David. But first, we're going to share some excerpts of a conversation with Reverend Jerry Colbert. So let me have you set us up here with a few words about where this tradition comes from and what Reverend Jerry is doing to keep it alive as a singing and praying band captain.
This is a tradition that's really distinct to the Tidewater region, the Chesapeake Bay. Really, Maryland and Delaware is where you find it today. It's tradition that's really centuries old, that is a combination of Christian gospel traditions and of West African religious traditions. The singing and praying bands are based out of a number of different churches in Delaware and Maryland, predominantly Maryland, and they have a regular season really from about late spring, early summer through the fall, where they travel to one another's churches and perform their form of music ministry. And so the chief way that they keep this alive is just by using it. I mean, this is a way of communing with the Holy Spirit.
That said, Cliff Murphy, we're going to turn things over now to the words of Reverend Jerry Colbert.
I was raised by my grandmother, and of course she was a part of the singing and praying band movement, and my older sister would not babysit, so I was dragged to church. It was an all-day event. It was just like enough of aprons and ladies and singing. And I vowed that if I would ever get away from the prayer band, that I would never, ever be a part of it again. Well, that was a lot of untruth. Here I am 40 years later, and the coordinator for the prayer bands. It's contagious. We talk about the Holy Spirit and the fire, and it gets into your spirit, it gets into your movement. And I believe that when you're born with something of this nature, it just becomes a part of you.
What are the secrets to being a good captain?
The secret of being a good captain is humbleness, being in prayer, and just being able to tune a hymn, and when it gets out of tune, to bring it back in tune. If the tempo is too slow, to be able to lift that tempo up or to bring them back down where they can catch their breath again to get another rhythm going. Good captains are spirit-led, spirit-fed. They are praying people. Of course, we call it the prayer band. We are praying people, but it's almost at another level where you, in the midst of all the different emotions, that you steer at a level where you communicate.
I wonder if you have a story of like a particularly powerful or moving spiritual moment that you might remember when someone was like really, you know, converted or taken into the spirit as a result of your group. I mean, talk about the power that this group can have, maybe some memories of what it's accomplished.
The memories of healing, the memories of conviction, when there were just really strong, powerful prayers and someone would come up and could even be not seeing well and vision restored, and that would release an applause or a hoop of thanksgiving. A lot of churches, black churches, we call it the hoop, you know, and you just, it's a way of expressing praise and thanksgiving to God. There are such things as when the prayer band would gather around the bedside of a sick person and healing would come in place. Person being delivered from any type of brokenness, from alcohol or those type of things. We don't actually reveal and see as much of that today as we did yesterday, but there are a lot of healing moments in the days of yesterday after prayer ban.
I wonder if you could maybe try and put into words just how it feels personally for you when you're, you know, caught up in that powerful column of sound. I mean, how would you describe that moment for yourself?
It's almost like a moment of being moved out of your body. It's an experience, and you don't see anybody else. You don't feel anybody else. And it's just you and God. There's a communication going on. You and God. That problem that I had yesterday, God has just taken care of it. If it was a healing problem, whatever society had thrown your way, you get caught up in a communion. And it's like an out-of-body experience. And you just slowly come back into it, and then you realize the joy of the Lord and the presence of the Lord.
How many hymns do you suppose you've got memorized?
Oh, God. Too many to even count. You have to remember that I started singing at 16 years old, and I'm 62 now, so That's a lot of hymns, and probably half of those hymns we don't even sing any longer because the persons who used to sing those are now gone to the great beyond or moved on to a higher calling, and the younger generation have not learned them. And because of time, the few of us that joined at a very early age, we just don't have the time to teach all those hymns. So the list has gotten shorter.
But I imagine they must be a really integral part of the fabric of your everyday life. They probably go through your head at, you know, the most unsuspecting moments. They probably keep you company through thick and thin, huh?
And that's true. There'll be times when I'll be riding along and I think of Brother Joe Spicer, you know, and when he would sing All of My Appointed Time, you know, I'll wait until my change come, and you start humming that, and you see Brother Spicer, and then you see Sister Suzanne Watkins and some of the old saints, and you just recall some of the hymns they sing. Brother Isaiah Hutt, and I happen to sing one of his songs now, There's a Fountain Filled with Blood Drawn from Emmanuel's Vein, and you just get caught up in that, and it becomes a part of you. Yeah. There is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's vein. There is a fountain filled with blood, what drawn from Emmanuel's vein. And sinners plunged beneath that flood lose all their guilty stains. And sinners plunge beneath that flood, lose all their guilty stains, and sinners plunge beneath that flood, and all their guilty stains.
Reverend Jerry Colbert, captain and coordinator of the Singing and Praying Bands. You're listening to a co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. When our program continues, we'll meet a woman who dedicated her life to the Singing and Praying Bands 76 years ago. She's been at it ever since. By the way, this episode of The Signal comes with an excellent multimedia companion piece put together by photographer Shane Carpenter, and you can check that out online at The Signal's Facebook page. We're up there under Signal Radio Baltimore. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
You have your open up service at the church, and then you have a congregation come in and preacher preach and the choir sing. Then they take up collection. And then they call in the singing and praying band. And everybody goes up and line up. They have a bench that go across. And then you have this grand march. You march it all the way down. Men go down one aisle and the women. And then you come back up the center aisle two by two. And back up to the front. And you move the bench back. And you just make a ring and just stand there and sing. Mm-hmm. It's something to see.
The voice of singing and praying band member Mary Allen of Baltimore as we get back into our program this week. It's The Signal from WYPR. I'm Aaron Hinken here in studio with folklorist Cliff Murphy. And Cliff, we're going to get into a conversation with Mrs. Allen in just a minute here. But first, let me ask you to say a few words about this field recording we're hearing right now, where it's from, and what exactly it is that we're listening to.
The singing and praying bands get their name. It's a descriptive name, really. The congregation moves from singing a hymn or lining out a hymn into the music will die off, and then the group will begin a prayer. Somebody will kind of come forward and begin to testify and to lead a prayer. And it's a very dynamic interaction between an individual and the rest of the congregation. It's all done around what's called the mourner's bench, which we'll hear about. In this recording, a song has just concluded. Mary Allen, who we just heard from, came forward and began to lead a prayer. And you'll hear some lines that come from biblical verses. You'll hear some lines that come from some of the hymns that they sing. And this is really to create a space for people who, what Reverend Jerry used was the word broken, people who are somehow spiritually broken, to come forward and to be saved.
I am Mary Allen. I am 86 years old. I was born in Baltimore, Maryland in 1925, August the 6th. The first of seven children. And my mother used to dress us every night when they had camp meetings around different churches, and we were small. And she did day work, and she came home and cleaned us up and fed us and took us, and we slept on the benches until the people finished singing. Mm-hmm. So I've always been around bands, mm-hmm. And I've always liked it. There's nothing like it. And you should hear us when we get together, the 6 head of us living. And we get together like for Mother's Day, or they'll come here. If I don't feel good, a couple of them will come here at the same time, and they'll get the singing and the patting going on. So we just sing anytime. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what happened to me. My father was a minister of a church, had his own church, and he was this preacher was running a revival there for a week. And on this Sunday night, when he extended the invitation, if anybody in his sinners wanted to come to join the church, to come on up. Well, I got up and went up there. And when I went up there, they told me I had to go to the mourner's bench. Well, back in those days, they had a bench that sit across the pulpit that they called the mourner's bench. And I said, okay, this was a Sunday night. They sang and prayed over me then. And then I went back Monday night, and they sang and prayed again over me. I went back Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night. That Friday night I went back. I remember going down to the mourner's bench, but I don't remember coming up. When I came to myself, I was running and shouting and thanking the Lord for saving me. And that's when I was, they say, converted. When the Lord shook the devil out of me, or what, back in those days, they would say those kind of things. But that was a wonderful feeling. And we had a good time, and I've been in it ever since then. That was a feeling you'll never forget.
Mm-mm. And it was something about the power of that music, you think, that would that really conveyed that conversion for you?
Well, the bands were singing over me, and I was down there asking the Lord. They told me, kept telling me, ask the Lord to have mercy on my soul. And that's what I kept saying. And I guess he finally did. Because when I come up shouting. When I come to myself, that's where I was crying and thanking the Lord for saving me. That's a wonderful feeling. I've seen the good times. Like when we used to go to McAfee on Sunday and Labor Day morning, it would just be in crowds of people, and we would march from the church down to the hall and back down to the old pump that was sitting at the gate. And oh, we used to have a good time. We get home on Monday morning, our hair would be almost white from the sand and the dust from marching up and down. But we enjoyed every minute of it, every minute of it. And it was some singing and praying people back in those days, because that's all you live for. In the morning when they used to get ready for the march, people would be in their cars sleeping, taking a break. And Alfred Green, Matthews, they were captain then. They would come out, come to the church door and blow a horn. And you would see them getting out those cars, getting ready for the march, the grand march from the church down to the schoolhouse, and from the schoolhouse back down to the pump at the gate, and then back up to the church. That was some march, I'm telling you. People used to live for that, and they still do. Some do. I do, too. Sometimes it wouldn't even be standing room in the church when the service would be going on, and bands would be inside the church singing and outside the church singing. Yeah, that was something to behold. We used to go three places on Sunday. We would go leave and go to Williamsburg in the morning on Eastern Shore, Gump Swamp on Eastern Shore, and then wind up at Ivorytown at night. And those, back in those days, people did hard work. Men worked on the railroad and stevedore, and women had large families, those that sang in the van, and they had their children, but Sunday they were there. And they would iron them uniforms. You could stand them up in the center of the floor and they wouldn't fall down. That's how they were starched. Yeah, them uniforms, you didn't mess with them uniforms now. Mm-mm. And back in those days, you know, every band from every church, because they had their own uniforms. Some had pink and white, and Metropolitan had bonnets with purple bands around them. Christ Methodist wore black hats with green around them. And I think ours was black round hats with the white ribbon around it. It was a beautiful sight. And then you had badges and you had cuffs and collars. You was uniform out.
So there was a real sense of pride and identity in being one of these groups.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. It was a pride in them uniforms. Them uniforms was just like uniforms, I guess, you wear when you go into service. Them uniforms, don't touch those uniforms. I'm a soldier bound for glory. I'm a soldier, go win home. I'm a soldier bound for glory. I'm a soldier, go win home. Come in here, me tell the story. All who love the Savior come. So that's how I would go.
Mrs. Mary Allen of Baltimore, remembering the heyday of Maryland's singing and praying bands. You're listening to The Signal on WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin, joined by Maryland Traditions folklorist Cliff Murphy, as we dedicate this week's radio program to a deeply rooted musical and spiritual tradition born in the Chesapeake Tidewater area some 200 years ago. And Cliff, we're going to hear Mary Allen talk a bit now about just how thin that tradition is getting these days. But first, a few words, if you would, about who these stalwarts are, who keep the tradition alive, how many of them are still out there, and what they're doing to keep the torch burning.
This tradition, just to give you a sense, I mean, the recordings that we made were made at Asbury Broadneck, which was founded by enslaved African-Americans prior to 1851. And this is a tradition that was alive in that area and has continued on and was very strong really until maybe 30 years ago when it started to diminish. And there's a lot of forces that play that have caused this tradition to diminish. And so you have people like Reverend Colbert and Mary Allen and a number of others kind of spread out through the region at a handful of churches who keep this going. Now, without these key individuals in the community, these very energetic and dedicated band captains who, you know, all these people have jobs. This is not a paying gig for anybody. Nobody gets any money. And everybody has to dedicate a pretty giant chunk of their life to perpetuating this tradition. And without these people there, I think this tradition would be at great risk.
Years ago, here in Baltimore City, it was almost a singing and praying band in every church in the city. But our purpose for singing and praying is that to bring sinners in. Like I say, almost every church had a singing and praying band, but it's just a few of them now. And like up to my church, it's just three of us. I have myself and a mother and daughter. And when I'm gone or something happened to me, Lydia says she'll keep it long as she can. And then when she's gone, that's it. It's no more singing and praying band. Because that's something that seemed like this generation is not taken to, you know. They'd rather sing on a choir, do something else like that, you know. They say we go too much. Well, you have to go to get people to come to you. Yeah. But I enjoyed it. I've been in it for 76 years. I've been in it a long time, and I have seen the good times, I'm telling you. And it used to be a great time at one time because people had nothing else to do but to go to church. and they look forward to coming and listening to the singing and praying band. Churches would have bands all through the week, and we would be walking to like 12:30 and 1 o'clock coming from singing and praying, and people would be sitting on the steps in the summertime and all like that. But you better not do that now. And like watch me tonight, New Year's Eve, people used to come out the bars just to be in church when the new year came in.
What do you think younger folks think when they see you guys up there doing what you're doing? Do you think it seems like something out of a history book to them, or do you, can they relate?
Crazy up there sweating. They don't think we really have good sense. Up there hooping and hollering, sweating, going on. Sometimes I had to look at them and say to myself, I guess you're all right. Because it's hot and we up in water just running down our face.
Music of the Singing and Praying Bands of Maryland, recorded on site at Asbury Broadneck United Methodist Church in Annapolis. You're listening to a co-production of The Signal and Maryland Traditions. When our program continues, scholar Jonathan C. David takes us back to the historical flashpoint when the worship style of enslaved Africans dovetailed with the Christianity of the Methodist Church. We'll also hear Reverend Jerry Colbert look ahead to the future viability of the singing and praying band tradition. Stay with us.
People are very emotional and very spirited, but they don't, it's not losing control. It's much deeper and more centered than that connection. And I felt that. And perhaps one of the reasons I kept going back is because that sense of connectedness is very real.
The voice of Jonathan C. David, author of the book Together Let Us Sweetly Live, A History of the Singing and Praying Bands. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin, here with Maryland Traditions folklorist Cliff Murphy. And Cliff, as we get ready to hear a bit more from Mr. David about the origins and underpinnings of the singing and praying bands, let me ask you to say a bit about who this researcher is and how he found his way into this particular field of study.
John David is a folklorist, a scholar who, as a young man coming out of University of Pennsylvania, as a graduate student, doing some field work in the Delmarva really kind of stumbled across this tradition. And I think that when he first arrived on the scene and first encountered this music, it was a little strange that he was there.
He stuck out. He was a white guy in the middle of this African-American tradition.
Yes. Yeah. And in the middle of an African-American tradition that did not take up much space in the consciousness of white people in the Delmarva. And so to have John there was a little strange. And he stuck around. He really dedicated himself to illustrating the history of this community, of documenting the stories of its participants. He has a great rapport with Reverend Colbert, which you'll hear, as well as a number of other elders in the community. And I think that they have appreciated the work that he's done, and they've also found it to be useful.
There was a time when, in the early 19th century, when Methodist missionaries began to fan out through the South and gained a lot of converts within the African-American community. But the African-American community was not a blank slate. There were religious traditions already going on among enslaved Africans for perhaps 100 or more years before that. Many of them based on whatever understanding of Christianity could be gotten under those hostile circumstances. Then you had the establishment of Methodist churches, but also you already had a pre-existing worship style. And there was something of a different emphasis between the members of a local community and the denomination as to where the life of the church was focused. Was it focused on this community style of worship that had been there all along, or was it focused in the official preachers and the doctrines of Methodism? And I think the pre-existing traditions came to be practiced in prayer meetings, not in the Sunday morning services, but in prayer meetings by and large. And the prayer meetings would take place on either Sunday evenings or weekday evenings. And then prayer meeting groups, in order to raise money for the churches, would sponsor camp meetings, which is a larger tradition all over America. But in this area, in the African-American churches, the camp meetings would be held on the church grounds and would be fundraisers. And it was the prayer meeting groups that ran the camp meetings. And so at the regional camp meetings, other prayer meeting groups would start coming to support the prayer bands of the host church. And when they began to travel, they began to call themselves singing and praying bands as opposed to just prayer meeting people. And it became an established long-term tradition within the Methodist churches of this area.
Singing is a part of the Black movement. It releases all that was pinned up within us. It gave us a sign of relief that, yeah, this God can do this. I don't have to worry about this right now. It was about praying for those living on the fringe of life. It was always about praying for the poor and the needed and praying for good marriages and brokenness. So even though there is a distinction between singing and praying, it still connects. It connects the embodiment of Christ and our commitment to the calling. And the communion that we get out of it, as in almost like going to the doctor and getting penicillin for a cold, and you take it and you feel better. And this was our penicillin when we were pressed down.
In poetics, Aristotle, the philosopher, defined catharsis as a purging of negative emotions and then leaving the human being in a state of calmness. I kind of think it's more a transformation of negative emotions, that if you begin the prayer meeting service with a sense of brokenness, and then if you suddenly realize that you have compassion for others who suffer and for yourself, and that compassion is a sign of perhaps of grace. But it is also a political movement. There was a time when African peoples in the United States would not have been all one people. And I believe that it was partially in the context of ring shouts and prayer meetings that African peoples became on one accord. You can see the earliest formation of African American identity here.
Observations from researcher Jonathan C. David, and before him, Reverend Jerry Colbert, on the social and political dimensions of the region's historical singing and praying bands. And folklorist Cliff Murphy, both these gentlemen during our interviews had some interesting things to say about the future of this tradition and how it might need to branch out, how it might need to evolve in order to survive more than a decade or two more into the future.
When we first pitched this idea to Reverend Jerry, it was, you know, again, somewhat unusual for someone on the outside to take an interest in this. And
the idea of a radio program about this phenomenon.
Yeah, and it has set a number of things in motion, interestingly enough, since then. One is that the tradition was recognized by Maryland Traditions with the Alta Award. It's really our most prestigious award that we recognize communities and individuals with achievements in living traditions and arts. And the singing and praying bands participated in a public concert that we had put on in Montgomery County. And this was back in December. And this was really one of the first times that they had carried out their music ministry outside of the church in a public arena. And one of the amazing things about this tradition is how democratic it is. The leaders of the community really kind of put it to a vote and said, you know, do we want to do this? Do we want to take this in a public sphere? And since then, you know, we're doing this radio program. We have the Maryland Traditions Festival, and they'll be participating in that. And also, you know, I know that they'll be appearing at the Library of Congress in August as well. And I think that this is an experiment of sorts on their part to see what can happen if they take this into a public sphere. Will it develop new interests in the tradition? Will it bring younger people, new people in to carry this forward?
The positive thing about taking this outside of the walls of the church into theaters and festivals is that we have a calling from different people who are interested and want to keep the movement going. And I think that as long as we don't forget our focus, I think that it will be around for a long time.
Well, one of the reasons, I mean, there are many reasons why the bands have dwindled in number. In part, I think everyone knows from the 1950s on, American society has gotten more mobile. And this is a family tradition. How can you keep your family tradition alive if your children are in Florida or in Washington State or in the, you know, a military base in Okinawa or Germany? But I know their religious and spiritual message is not bound to this small community within the tidewater areas of Maryland and Delaware, that it is a universal phenomenon that can transform people's lives.
It gets painful at time when I think about what the prayer band will look like in 10 years from now. No one knows what tomorrow brings or holds for any of us, but it's my prayer that there will be some unity of identity 10 years from then, even if most of us are not there. And so I just pray continuously that the strength and the foundation will stay stable, and whoever the leaders are after me, that they'll be faithful to their calling and not forget the church.
Parting words this hour from Reverend Jerry Colbert, band captain and coordinator for the singing and praying bands. We also heard this hour from lifelong band member Mary Allen of Baltimore and historian Jonathan C. David, author of Together, Let Us Sweetly Live. You've been listening to The Signal, an original production of WYPR in Baltimore. This week's episode has been produced in collaboration with Cliff Murphy, and Michelle Stefano of Maryland Traditions and the Maryland State Arts Council. Cliff, thank you as always, sir.
Thanks, Aaron. It's been great.
Thanks go out also to Hannah Rogers for her transcription services and to Shane Carpenter, who took some beautiful photos and video of the singing and praying bands. I highly recommend that you check out his excellent multimedia companion piece. It's online at our Facebook page. You can find us up there at Signal Radio Baltimore. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening. Finally, this hour, a calendar note. The singing and praying bands are going to be appearing at this year's Maryland Traditions Folklife Festival. This is a free, day-long festival. It happens on June 13th at the Creative Alliance, with two music stages, craft demos, and workshops and activities for all ages. The singing and praying bands are going to take the stage at the festival on Saturday, June 13th at noon. You can find more information online at creativealliance.org.